Abiola Ogunbi, we are here to share the original and memorable insights that we find in new books written by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, arts, and culture. In this episode...
Hi, my name's Max Dickens, author of Improvise, and this is my Omi for Bukomi.
We meet the director of Hoopla, the UK's first improvisation training school, who wants you to use whatever you've currently got to get wherever you want to at work.
Seeing how much of our life we don't turn up prepared, and improv offers a methodology to deal with those situations.
In his new book, Improvise, Use the Secrets of Improv to Achieve Extraordinary Results at Work, Max Dickens shares the rules and techniques that help performers on stage look confident and in control of their creativity, and shows us how we can apply these techniques in our work and our everyday lives to be more flexible in our thoughts, connected in our relationships, and willing to try our best, whatever cards we're dealt with. Max, a warm welcome to the Bukomi podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. I should have got you to write the blurb for my book. That was the best I've ever heard it explained. Thank you.
You've written a book about, you know, taking what we're given in life, whether that's on stage, in our lives, and making the best of that. And I wonder if you needed to apply some of those principles into your writing of the book now that you had the opportunity to distill everything you've learned into narrative and into book form.
That's a really good question. So did I improvise when I wrote the book? Yes, I did, in two respects. In that, whenever you write a first draft of everything, or of anything, I should say, you do sort of a splurge, and it's all over the place a little bit, and then you bring back the rigor, and you structure it, and you get a load of notes, and you find a load of evidence for things. So I think that's maybe a little nuance that we can maybe introduce right at the start in a discussion about improvisation, because people think of it as being very right-brained and a bit chaotic. But what we're trying to do is harness the spontaneity, and then also bring the other form of thinking when that's suitable too. So the first draft was improvised. The second draft was not improvised, although I got loads of notes, obviously, from my editor, a selection of readers, target readers that I gave it to, from my partner. And obviously, I had my own notes as well. And I had to respond to those. So in that sense, I was improvising. But it was a balance between improvisation and really rigorous analytical thinking, which I think if people can apply to their work and their daily lives, they can get huge benefit from. But what I'm not saying is that everything should be improvised. It's just that we maybe disdain the spontaneous, and we get attached to scripts, and we pre-plan too much, and we use it as a crutch.
I wonder, in your experience working with the many companies and clients that you have, why you think that it's so difficult at the beginning to do that divergent thinking?
Yeah, I mean, time is certainly a challenge. So maybe we should just pull this back slightly. And so I just contextualize it within a principle in the book, and then listeners can maybe connect to this and use this practically. And as I do so, I'll answer that really important question you've just asked me there. So improvisation is based around a philosophy, a mindset that we call yes and on the surface level, it's a pretty simple idea. It's you give me an idea, Abby, and I accept it, and I build on it with something of my own. I accept what we would call your offer, and I build on it with my own offers. And what we're trying to do is come up with lots of solutions, lots of creative ideas with a very positive yes and mindset. And then what we might do, as you put yourself, is later on in any creative process or any collaborative process, is bring in a much more critical view. So perhaps we're bringing in things to do with budget, or things to do with practicalities, things to do with morality, all these reasons we have to say no, which are good reasons, but we delay judgment. We bring them in a bit later. And if we do that, what you find is you get much more innovative solutions. You allow yourself to think a lot more laterally. But what we're trained to do from school through our careers is to do these two types of thinking, the yes andy type thinking and the very critical analytical type thinking, almost simultaneously. So as soon as an idea pops up, we kill it either in ourselves or in another person. So what we want to do is spend longer in that yes and mode and be mindful when we're getting into that critical mode without a sense of intention or without knowing we're doing it. Now, that idea in itself is quite a straightforward one. Like, people go, right, I get it. Yes and. Okay, let's use it. But the challenge people have in using it in context is to do with the emotional blockers we have. So that often in our workshops, we'll get people to do interactive exercises where they'll try on these concepts for size. And they're simple intellectually, but what they find is that they're difficult to execute because of these emotional blockers, usually in terms of ego. We don't want to accept and build on ideas because we want to get our own idea out there. Or fear. We're afraid of uncertainty. We're afraid, as you put it, that we haven't got enough time. We're afraid that our idea is going to look stupid or that it's going to fail. So when we have awareness of these emotional blockers, it allows us to actually spend longer in that divergent mode and use it with more intentionality in our lives.
One of the things that I really found really enlightening and empowering about your book is that you take a principle, an exercise that started perhaps in a more theatrical performative space and transfer it not only to work and business, but then transfer it to the way that we just go about our day-to-day lives.
Yeah. So I think there's two inside that are kind of two challenges you might have to the use of improvisation in your life or in your career. The first one, I suppose, is relevance. People go, well, you know, so what? This kind of improv stuff is about comedy, right? It's about theater. I'm not on stage. How can I use that? But what is improvisation? Improvisation is the art of acting without a script. Now often this happens on stage. Of course it does, in shows like Whose Line Is It Anyway? Theaters in like Second City in Chicago or UCB in New York or Hoopla even in London. But how much of our daily lives are we forced to act without a script? Communication fundamentally is unscripted, especially when it's done well. So, you know, you're interviewing me here and I'm sure you've got a degree of preparation in your interviewing, but also you're responding to what I'm saying and I feel heard and understood and seen. And we're doing that all the time, whether we're working with our colleagues, when we're pitching to clients, talking to our children, our spouse. So the relevance is seeing how much of our life we don't turn up prepared, and improv offers a methodology to deal with those situations really well. And then the second objection is maybe fear. Like, why would you, if you were nervous and scared, turn up at a class or use these concepts? And I think fundamentally improv is not about performance. It's not about speaking even. And people think, oh God, public speaking is, people say it's more scary even than death. And they kind of curl up into a ball when they don't want to be putting themselves out in front of people. But really the secret of improvisation is about being focused on the other person. It all begins with listening. In fact, I dedicate about a third of the book onto listening and noticing what's actually there. And if you can focus on the other person, the anxiety drips away. We say in improv, if you want to get out of your head, and that's where we feel nervous, that kind of anxiety is energy directed inwards, that rumination. If you want to get out of your head, get into something else. And that other person or that other thing is the person we're talking to. So it's about really putting your focus on them and responding to what they're giving you, noticing what they're giving you. So if you're nervous, really I'd say it's not about you. And if you remember that, your communication will go through the roof in terms of its impact.
There are so many unique offerings that people around us can give. You present so many wonderful case studies in the book about different people in different lines of work and what they have gained from improv.
Two immediately come to mind. And the first one is one that I found very moving, and it's included in the book. In fact, I put it in the last chapter, the conclusion, because I felt it was so representative of the power of some of these ideas. And is from somebody who was a student at Hoopla at time I met him, a guy called Pete, and his mother had dementia. And anyone who's known anyone with that sort of illness, it's very difficult because their version of reality is no longer rational. It's no longer what any of us would consider reality, and that can be quite hard to deal with. And she was in a home, and she was refusing to take her medicine because they were saying that the drink that the nurses were giving her was poisoned. So she was refusing to take her medicine for her Alzheimer's. And Pete's father was just, you know, beyond himself, just didn't know what to do. Had been trying all day to do this, trying to get to say, well, of course it's not poisoned. Look, please take your medicine. But Pete had been in our classes, and he took a completely different approach. He took a much more of a, as we've been describing already, a yes and approach. He said to his mother, yeah, they have been poisoning your drink, and it's absolutely awful. And I'm so glad you told me, and I'm on your team here, and we're going to sort this out. And he played with this reality, and then he said, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this drink, and I'm personally going to go and get you a fresh one that's absolutely, absolutely perfect for you. And so he leaves the room, and he's got the same drink in his hand. He comes back in and he gives her the drink, and she takes the medicine with the same drink she'd rejected, and then everything was fine. And of course, tomorrow she's completely forgotten the idea about the nurses poisoning her drink. But it was, I heard that and went, wow, this is showing how this thing that could feel irrelevant, this technique from the stage, can be used to really connect to another person and add a huge benefit to them. So that was one. And it just stuck with me because it was just such a interesting application of it. And then, a more fundamental one was, a more fundamentally businessy one was, we've had, I know a guy from, I won't necessarily name the startup, he's a guy called Eric, but he emailed me the other day and he said, we've just landed 7 million quid's worth of venture capitalist funding, and it was using all these techniques that I learned in improv classes. Because fundamentally, pitching is, you've got to be credible, you've got to have the information, you've got to have the value to add, of course, but it's, can you relate it in the room, and can you land it in the room? And all the stuff that he'd learned in an improvisation class had given them all these tools that he could use. And I think this is maybe a good thing to sort of talk about in our discussion today, because improv is about making your expertise and your knowledge and your value relevant in the moment, because it's no longer useful in a world full of change to just know stuff. You have to apply it in the moment and make it adaptable to the change in front of you. And this is what this gentleman had used in the pitching situation and got such a great result.
There's an idea of reading into body language and into non-verbal cues. Absolutely. As well.
Absolutely, yeah. So we have this idea of offers in improv. And when you understand the word offers, you kind of see the world in those terms. So an offer might be an idea, a word I say to you. So I'm giving you various offers that you can listen and pick up on. But also an offer might be my tone of voice. It might be how I'm holding myself. It might be how I walk into the room. And people who are amazing communicators, the people we love having on our teams at work, or the people we love being in relationships with, the people that really attune to those offers that are unsaid. You know, somebody comes into a room and you can tell by the way they're walking, something's up, and you can say, you can label it, that you seem down today, and you're giving them a license to say how they feel and to really connect with them. But people who are stuck in their head, stuck in their script, stuck in what they're going to say, miss all this nonverbal and tonal offers. And that's when their communication gets into conflict, or that's when they make other people feel unheard, unseen, and unappreciated.
What would you say perhaps is one of the, like, the first step to getting unstuck? The key steps that might help with those emotional blocks for someone trying to bring some of that spontaneity, that agility into their lives?
I would say, firstly, it starts in self-awareness. You realize what those emotional blockers are, and they tend to be similar for most people, but kind of understand that when that kind of internal monologue that comes into your head in certain moments, in moments of uncertainty, when we communicate, when we come up against conflict, when we have an instinct to shut an idea down, just be aware of those and remember that there may be instincts and not the most appropriate response. So it starts in self-awareness. And then I think in terms of unblocking yourself, a lot of it is about your mental model that you have when it comes to change and also failure. So our automatic mental model in lots of people is change equals bad, failure equals disaster. And change happens and we freeze, a mistake happens and we freeze and we go into kind of, we cascade into a shame response, we become paralyzed. Whereas a mental model that improvisers learn all through their training is that everything is an offer. So we've talked about offers already, but everything is an offer. So treat mistakes, treat change as if it's serendipitous. If you have that mindset, you'll start to see the offers incumbent in change and incumbent in your own mistakes. A great example is as you express yourself, is what's happened since the COVID crisis. Huge disruption. And you have two responses to that. You can either freeze, feel sad, feel grief, and there's definitely a process that we've all gone through with that. But also you can then go, well, what's the offer here? And the offer is, the disruption has broken us out of old habits. It's opened up new ways of seeing and doing that in the long run are going to be absolutely transformative to our lives. From my own perspective, we we mentioned it just before we began this interview. Hoopla it was a company entirely based on face-to-face workshops and a comedy club, right? COVID was perfectly designed to kneecap us. We've had to reinvent the wheel a little bit and put it all our offering online. And we've learned so much. But what it's allowed me to do is to do work with people all over the world, to deliver material in a way that I've really expanded my skill set. And also for us to really connect with people. So our customers really wanted human connection, especially through that first lockdown, and we were able to really offer that to them.
What you've said and the story that you've shared is, it shows us that within the limits, within boundaries that we're given, there's actually an offer in a way of so much more creativity.
So much of our relationships in real life are like that. So as another example, I'm very happy to talk about this, but for another creative project, I've started having psychotherapy, which I've never done before. And it's been a fascinating process. And in many senses, therapists are the best improvisers in the world, I think. but therapists will talk to you about this idea of relationships and about how so much of our growth in relationships is about coming up with obstruction and with conflict and with change. So in our partner, we often get into conflict with our partner. And this is, read this for your friendships or for your colleagues at work. We get into conflict often when the other person represents a strength that we don't have or a weakness we have. And we have to process that through conflict in order to become more rounded as a human being. And seeing the messiness of that interaction as a gift and not as a show-stopping disaster, a therapist will tell you, is central to building great relationships and to personal and relational development. So I think this stuff is not just on stage, although on stage it's very compelling to watch, to see performers work through those sticky bits, work through the errors. But in real life, I'd ask people, mate, if you're listening to this podcast, think about your relationship with your spouse or with somebody at work you find really hard. Where's the offer in that? What can you learn from that? And what does that teach you about yourself that you can then use that as an asset to work through?
Thank you so much, Max. Max Dickens' book, Improvise, Use the Secrets of Improv to Achieve Extraordinary Results at Work, is available to buy now, and you can use the link on the podcast description to get your copy today. And if you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, be sure to subscribe to the Bocomi podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Abiola Ogunbi. Stay safe, and don't worry if you have to make it up as you go along sometimes.